For more information on ancient dragon Zengate and Taigen's teachings, please visit our website at www.ancientdragon.org. Our teachings are offered to the community through the generosity of our supporters. To make a donation online, please click on the link for Just Give on our website.
Good morning, everybody. Even as a mother with her life protects her child, her only child, so with a boundless heart should we cherish all living beings. This is from the Metta Sutta, as I'm sure many of you recognize. Those of you who are staying through the morning, it's what we'll be chanting later. And this morning I want to talk about something related to this. The line from the Metta Sutta suggests that we look at this very special, sort of paradigmatic relationship between mother and child, not only mother and child, but a mother and her only child, completely undivided. It's very particular, unique, special, powerful thing, and open that and turn it to the whole world. Something like that. So I want to talk about a mother in the sort of literature of Buddhism, who was not able to protect her child, but was able to open her heart. This is a story that's not from the Zen tradition. It's not even from the Mahayana tradition. It's from the Pali literature. But I'm going to tell the story, and I'm going to try to open it up in a slightly Mahayana way, I hope, and then make a few comments about a kind of light I think the story may shed on Zazen, this practice we're doing together this morning, itself. It's the story of Kisokotami. I'm sure that many of you know this story. It's very widely disseminated, very short, and so I'll just kind of recite it or tell a version of it. I know that many people here have talked about this story and read about this story. So at that point, after I do the basic facts, if anybody would like to add anything, if I've missed something crucial, please do. As I said, this story is widely disseminated. I'll take the opportunity here to say that it's one of the places you can find it. And it's this relatively recent book, maybe 2 or 3 years old, The Hidden Lamp, which is a variety of stories taken from the wide sort of sweep of the Dharma with commentaries by contemporary teachers. Kisokotomi was a low-caste, very poor woman who was a contemporary of the Buddha in India. In fact, she was not the first woman to ordain as a nun under Buddha, but she is said to be the first who came to an awakening of a kind. And I don't know what the name Gotami means. I've seen some things that suggest that it might mean mustard seeds. Mustard seed, that plays in the story. I don't know. The Kisa part means something like thin or little. I've seen it even described, even sort of glossed as emaciated or haggard. And it's a reference to the poverty in which she grew up. I mean, she had a hard life in the social arrangements of India of the day. She didn't have a lot going for her. However, she was able to marry well, as they say. Much more higher caste, more affluent fellow took a trying to her and or whatever, and married her. And there are stories that account for this, her activities in early life, her commitments to previous Buddhas and so on, that would explain this term. But anyway, she became part of this family, and she, other than with her husband, she was not well treated. She was not respected, this went on for a while, and then she became pregnant and produced a son, and all of a sudden her social horizons changed. Her family took her, the family she'd married into, started treating her with respect and dignity, and things were looking up. Her child died quite young. Some of the stories say 6 months. Some describe a toddler running around a little bit. But the son died. And with that, she not only experienced the loss of this child, but she lost in her place in this family. She was cast out. And in her grief became quite, I think we could say, deranged. She took the corpse of her baby and carried it around, and she would approach people, she would approach strangers, anybody she could find, and she would beg them to give her medicine to revive her child. And you know, they'd say, no, you're crazy, lady. I mean, your child's dead, you know. You have to accept this. And she'd go to somebody else, and she'd go to somebody else, and she got a reputation for just being, in her grief, a madwoman. I mean, people would drive her away, mock her. It was not a good situation. And eventually somebody took some pity on her or whatever, and said, you know, I don't have any medicine for you, but you might go and talk to this teacher nearby who maybe he'll have something for you. And the teacher, of course, was Buddha. And so she went and found Buddha and explained her situation. And Buddha said, I will give you medicine. Medicine that will revive your child. If you can bring me a mustard seed from a family that has been untouched by death. So she was very hopeful, you know, she immediately started going out again, importuning everybody she could meet, and sort of saying, you know, do you have a mustard seed that I can take to this fellow, the Buddha? And most people were, you know, yeah, we can give you a mustard seed. And then she'd say, well, but actually, there's something else. It has to be from a family that has not experienced any death. Does that apply to you? And of course, it was always, no, you know, I had a child myself who died 2 years ago, or my mother died, or my next door neighbor died. I mean, this was an impossibility. The Buddha had given her an impossible task. But, you know, she traveled around and talked to all these people, and she came to see that. She came to see her own situation in a different way. And she returned to the Buddha and was able to let go of this child, literally, and she ordained. And as I said, she became an arhat. And the way this story is told normally is that the reason she was able to sort of wake up is because in this process of going around to these different people, she had this profound understanding of the nature of impermanence. Now, impermanence is what in Buddhism is one of what's sometimes called the Trilakshana, the three marks. These three marks are impermanence, anatman or non-self, and suffering. And these are said to characterize all conditioned being. So, you know, minimally we can say, you know, us, human experience, all, when we go through, most of what we experience in some way or another is touched by all of these three things that are, sometimes it's a mark, sometimes it's, they're described as seal, something that is sort of stamped on our experience. And they all kind of imply each other. So, you know, in the story, the one that's highlighted is impermanence, but we can certainly see sort of aspects of the other two. Perhaps the least obvious one is this notion of non-self, which is a very deep and interesting sort of notion. But at like some very basic level, we can see that role, see its role in the story. The stories, the narrative that Kisako Tomi comes to have of herself disappears. She was a mother. Well, she was a mother. She had a place in this family, some degree of security. Well, she did, but now she doesn't. You know, and we might even say that in the story, that part of what's going on, in addition to her grief, her very understandable grief for her child, is sort of this clinging to these stories and taking her loss and this injury as somehow definitive of what her life is, who she is. But that's maybe not quite an accurate way to think of it. And surely she's not the only person who has a propensity to do this. We all do this, as I think we can see if we look in our experience very deeply. Much more obvious of these three marks is the suffering. You know, it's clear that this woman is really, really distraught, kind of broken. It's sort of a pathetic situation that the story finds her in initially. But I think in the context of the story, we can sort of look at kind of two kinds of suffering. You know, there's the very real suffering of the loss of her child as such, and the loss of her social identity, and all that kind of thing. Certainly not negligible. Very, very serious kind of thing. But on the other hand, there's this other kind of suffering, this sort of more pervasive and deeper, more universal kind of suffering that's expressed in the story. And that has to do with, I think, the way that in the face of her situation, she's not prepared, does not have the tools, does not have the karma, whatever it is, she's not able to deal with her situation in a constructive or skillful way. She becomes completely unbalanced until she meets the Buddha. And again, I mean, I'm reluctant to say that because given her situation, it seems a bit cold and ungenerous to say that Kisako Gotami's actions are not skillful. But I think we can see that she is completely undone, completely stuck in her undoneness. Things are not good. Before she meets the Buddha. And again, you know, that's, you know, it's sort of maybe an extreme case, but that's often our situation as individuals, or at least, you know, I won't generalize. Say that's my situation. I've been distraught in this really unbalanced way. that's described here in a couple of circumstances in my life. And even when I'm carrying out my normal life on a fairly even keel or whatever, I can see my own unskillfulness in respect to confronting the human situation, beyond human actually, but the human situation of the circumstance of impermanence and non-self and our resistance to that and all that kind of thing. So, and I think that that's the more fundamental kind of stuff for me that's sort of being exemplified here. Although, I mean, as I tried to indicate in this quotation from the Metta Sutta, I mean, in the story, they're using this very sort of particular kind of thing, the death of a child, to sort of exemplify, I think, this broader human situation. Okay, so the story is told, and it's said that Kisakatomi has a deep insight into the nature of impermanence, and by extension, deep insight into the nature of these three marks, and is thereby awakened. And in fact, in the Southern Asian non-Mahayana tradition, there are places where it's said that simply waking up to impermanence, non-self, and sufferings, having insight into those, is itself constitutive of enlightenment or nirvana. That's what one tradition holds that it is. And I have no doubt whatsoever that deep appreciation of, for example, impermanence could and probably is in and of itself very liberating. But I think so it's a powerful teaching. But I think as a Mahayana practitioner, a Zen practitioner, the power of this story for me is somewhere else. The story says, by way of seeing that everyone experiences death, Kisakatomi sees into the nature of the three marks, specifically impermanence, and that liberates her. And that's fine as far as it goes, but I'd kind of like to flip it a little bit and sort of suggest that it's by seeing into the nature of the three marks that she's able to see that all beings suffer, that dukkha is a reality of human life, and that it's rather than her encounter with these other people gives her insight into impermanence, I think that the real power of the story is that she sees that experience is shared, that we're in this together. I think that Mahayana sort of side of things is implicit in the story from the beginning. I mean, we can talk about, these three marks. That's very close, not identical, but very close to the notion of sort of emptiness, shunya, which is very close, maybe not identical, but very, very close to dependent co-arising, which is very, very close to non-separation, that we're all in this together, we're on this boat, and that becomes the kind of basis for sort of compassion. So I think that's an important part of the story. I'd like to talk about another aspect of the story, which is Buddha's skillful means. If you look at the story, there's kind of a bait and switch kind of situation. He makes this promise to her, but it's a conditional promise. I will revive your baby. I can give you medicine that will revive your baby if she can bring a mustard seed from someone who's not been touched by death. He doesn't reason with her, doesn't present her with any doctrine, he doesn't chastise her for being a little bit unhinged, but he gives her this task, and it's a task for which he has full knowledge she will not be able to carry out. There are no such families. Buddha is not in the business of raising people from the dead. So he knows this is not going to happen. But he appeals directly to this unrealistic, self-interested, delusional project that she has to bring her son back to life and to her wish to be free of suffering. But the interesting thing is that exercise in itself forces her out of her sort of absorption with her own grief and into a more sort of inquiring attitude towards the world and toward others, and a more realistic appreciation of our shared human situation. So he appeals to, the Buddha appeals to this Kisugatomi sense of this medicine that she thinks she wants, something that will bring her child back to life, something that will make the world conform to her sense of how it's supposed to be, so that he appeals to that so that on her own she will find a way to opening her eyes to this broader situation. So, you know, that's the skillful trick of the story that Buddha plays on her. You know, she thinks she's going to find a medicine that will bring her baby back to life, and instead she learns to rather than getting the medicine she wants, she gets a medicine that she needs, which is to somehow shift her the exclusivity of her gaze from her own suffering and her own sense of loss. And, I think that if we examine our experience, a lot of us have had this experience of sort of getting kind of hypnotized by our own pain. And Buddha kind of tricks her out of that. And in doing so, exposes her to the basis of compassion. So the key for getting unstuck is to overcome this sort of narcissistic and destructive, understandable, but still destructive fixation on her own grief. That is key. It's not her comprehension of the three marks, but coming to the end, realization at the end of the day that we're in the same boat and then acting on that. I'll just let that idea go there. And I'd like to close with a suggestion that there's a kind of a powerful parallel in the way the story unfolds with how the practice of Zazen itself unfolds. And again, I won't generalize too much, but I'll speak from my own experience, which is that I began the practice of Zazen, maybe in the same kind of spirit that Kisugatomi had when she was seeking medicine to revive her dead child. I'm just maybe not as desperate as she was, but I was looking for something that would fix me, that would take care of my own confusion and sense of hurt and loss and craziness and all those things that are probably not unfamiliar to at least some of you here. And, this awkwardness and discomfort of being a human being, right? And, I'm not saying that Zazen will not provide that. It can. But part of the magic, I think, of Zazen is it does this in a way that's completely different than we expect, rather, to go back to Kisugatomi, rather than giving us this medicine that we think that we want, it gives us this medicine that we maybe need. It's something in a way we could say it's not a cure, but but it's healing. And it has to do, I think, with the way it releases us over time from this fixation on a inaccurate and ultimately harmful sort of sense of who and what we are, this kind of fixation. So it was, we start off in zazen, like, or I started off in this kind of self-fixated way, but oddly enough, I think I, and I'll extend it here, we, you know, if we do this wholeheartedly in the way that Kisoko Tami sought to bring back her child, even though it's kind of like, in some sense, doomed, mistaken, wrong, it's like we start from the wrong place, right? Even so, if we do it wholeheartedly, we find that our sort of absorption and our own difficulties in wishful thinking begin to lessen, and our concern broadens. We become softer and more caring, and we find that as we become softer and more caring, that maybe impermanence and non-self are not problems in the same way we thought they were, and ergo we can become more skillful in how we live those situations, and further by doing so also alleviate our own sense of dissatisfactoriness of suffering and that of others. So at the end of the day, from the perspective of practice, the actions that matter are those that help us find a more wholesome relationship to our human situation and to open to others, and in a sense to no longer despise or fight with these three marks of existence that are somehow, you know, seeing them as somehow personal, somehow against us, somehow unfair, and instead see them simply as the context of practice and compassionate activity that we undertake together. So that's pretty schematic, but that's what I have to say. And I'd be very interested if anybody has any comments or questions. Getsu.
Thank you very much for telling this really wonderful story. And as you were talking, I was, you know, in some kind of Mahayana mode and thinking, you know, this is like a support group. Like, she's going to everyone with her, but like a mustard seed, you know. I don't know if anybody's like cooked Indian food, but like mustard seeds are like tiny little things. Everybody's got them in their house, right? It's like, oh yeah, I can give you a mustard seed. And then you have a conversation. And it's an intimate conversation, you know? Like, it's, yeah, thanks for that mustard seed. By the way, has your house been touched by it? Well, no, actually, it has been touched by loss. I think that kind of sense of connection is, like, talks about Sangha, too. You know, that she's making the entire world Sangha.
Yeah.
Like, if each one of us went to each other and said, oh, yeah, can I, you know, borrow mustard seed? By the way, you know, do you ever have any loss in your life? Oh, by the way, yeah, and start crying and sharing. I mean, I feel like sometimes the story, it's a little desiccated in the sense that that kind of emotional connection and interpersonal experience can sort of feel like, you know, eked out by maybe the, you know, Pali verses or something. But, you know, I thought the way you told it too was so nice, because it's not just about not seeing non-self, but it's about connecting.
Yeah, it's not this thing of like seeing all these people is not incidental to the story, and it's kind of, the way the story's presented, it's just kind of like just part of the scenery. But it's not, I don't think. It's very key.
Yeah, thank you.
Well, thank you. Yes.
Thank you for your lovely talk. The skillful means is really interesting to think about. I had an experience on Friday. I was asked to write a short article about a program for veterans with PTSD who are taking a photography class, and I really had no idea what to expect. And then I was told that these were people that everyone wanted their apartment and were really depressed and suicidal. And they were offered a class to learn computers and cameras. And somehow that was enough of a draw that they signed up for this class. What they were really doing was they were being taken out into natural areas to photograph flowers and trees and butterflies, and they were helping each other learn these skills. And they've been doing this for about 6 months, and after talking to them for a couple of hours, I asked them, so what did they like about the class? Oh, they like the people. Oh, they like the nature. It had nothing to do with the cameras and the computers. But I think if they had been asked to come out and take a nature walk or to, you know, they would have just, at least that was my understanding. So it was really quite lovely that they were, it was skillful.
Yeah.
And they even told, two of them told me that they decided to volunteer to help abuse animals. You know, they were then giving that, finding it in themselves to give back part of just having been brought into a little sangha, I guess, this little 10 people out in nature with their cameras. So anyway, thank you.
Again, thank you. That was wonderful. I was thinking about that baby, that child, and how we all carry around that child, and how she hangs on to delusions that, in her mind, about the child, how we hang on to delusions, and how we have to see past that and do zazen so that we see past the delusions, and how we are all under delusions, we are all suffering.
That's a really good point. This is actually something an idea that I thought about sort of developing more in my talk than I wound up having time to. But just this idea, as you say, you know, we all carry around a lot, and it doesn't in many ways serve us or anybody else, and there becomes a time for letting go, and zazen is an incredibly powerful tool. I think the best tool, for me, the tool that allows us to do that. And it's not a matter, something else that should have been said. I don't think it's a matter of, Kisoka Tomi. Again, as Hogetsu said, the story winds up, it sounds kind of cold, like she sees this nature of impermanence. I really doubt, and I hope it's not the case, that she never again cried for her child, whom I hope she continued to love. So it's not like that. But there's a way to have that, but to also let go. And we all need to do that in many ways.
Something else came up for me.
Sure.
As you were talking, and this is like something that I find so inspiring, is about how gentle Buddha is. Like, there's many stories where Buddha addresses people like as friend, or somebody wants to go and do something, and he's like, I don't think that's a really good idea, and the person's like, I really want to do that, and he goes, okay, well, I'm still here for you. And in the same way, like, he didn't try to get rid of her pain in this way, you know, like he said, okay, enter into it fully, mm-hmm. and I'll hang out with you and I'll be here when you come back.
Yeah.
You know, so there's something about the kindness of his speech that I feel is really moving for me. So thanks for bringing that up too. So got about 20 Dharma-tons in there.
Sorry. It's a problem, you know, one thing connects to another thing, and pretty soon you're trying to do the whole works. So
we're actually right at the time we're scheduled for. We have a long period of walking meditation. So if we have time, if there are any other
last remarks, questions?
Oh, yeah. You know, just what occurred to me was the when you get to the point of where, in some religions, you get to the point of, you know, dealing of the issue of the dead baby and everything, and the avatar or the, you know, holy person would, we're going to have a miracle.
Yeah.
You know, and the, you know, and the baby's back, or the mother's back, or the father's back, you know, kind of thing, but, so it is, you know, of course, more realistic to just, you know, deal with the, that situation as it is. So I was reminded of that. So
yeah, no, I mean, it's you know, part of the reason, part of the power of the story is that presenting it in that way, a mother's loss of a child, you know, is this particularly acute presentation of something more true. But as you say, it's more realistic, as you know, one of the other polytexts says, and this is one that Hogetsu's talked about here, I've talked about it here too, this what is called the sometimes called the five contemplations, the last of which is that we are the heir of our actions, but the first four of which are, you know, we are of the nature to become sick, we're of the nature to become old, we're of the nature to die. And then the fourth one is that we will be separated from all that we hold dear and cherish. And, you know, so, you know, at the end of the day, you know, should the child have sort of miraculously risen back to life, there would still be that parting, and at some point, and it still needs to be addressed. Interestingly, that same text, the Five Contemplations, doesn't end there. There's a section that follows that, which I very rarely noticed, or just noticed for the first time, and I don't think I've heard it talked about so much, but it goes on to say is that, you know, of the of the person that they notice that it's not only them who is of the nature to grow old, go sick and die, but it's the nature of everybody. And that's the situation we're in. And then it goes on to say, and this gives rise to the idea of practice. You know, so again, it's very similar to the story, or obvious parallels to the story of Kisa Gotami. And then it goes on to say, gives rise to the idea of practice, and gives rise to the idea of living without props. And I don't know exactly what that means. It's very intriguing. But I think part of what it might mean is, you know, getting over, you know, this sort of much exercise effort we make in towards avoiding impermanence, avoiding suffering, avoiding self. Well, you know, in some sense, there is no avoiding it, right? So yes, we need to be realistic, and it serves us to be realistic.
And then just and then also in the society, we have so many more powerful ways of creating the illusion that things will never end, and that you know, we will be restored to health, and everybody's going to live, you know, 95 years and stuff like that. So the and which is a big change from the origins of, you know, the Buddhist doctrines, you know, as they were then.
You know, the boundaries of the situation have changed. You know, more of us live to 95 years, but the situation itself is kind of similar.